Good evening.
I think, you know, why don't we start with reading the front, the quote at the beginning of the second commitment. Would somebody like to read that?
What page?
That's on page 63. It's just where it says the second commitment. Just the quote there.
63. I'll read it. Second commitment, committing to take care of one another. Taking the vow to help others implies that instead of holding our own individual territory and defending it tooth and nail, we become open to the world that we are living in. It means we're willing to take on greater responsibility, immense responsibility. In fact, it means taking a big chance. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche.
Okay. Just, you know, I can't remember if we discussed this before, but in Buddhism, when we take a vow, it somehow changes or alters the structure of our mind. Do you remember that? We were talking about that earlier. That actually, this is unusual, that the way Buddhism describes, you know, how we have various aspects of the mind. We have these various things like skandhas, and we have karma, you know, and we have the becoming, stages of becoming and all that. But actually, one interesting factor is when you actually make a commitment, meaning taking a vow, like the first vow, which is basically related to refuge, we're actually altering the nature of our mind. So maybe we even know that already without ever having anybody telling us that, you know? That's why so many people hold off. Yeah, I don't know if I want to get into this. Because, you know, it does really switch somehow the circuitry a little bit. And then the path of actually engaging with Dharma practice, in addition to studying it, is actually where we do, our minds do go through alteration and change, and the kind of karma we experience changes. So that's really important. And particularly since we get to this, we've been discussing, although I missed a couple of classes at first discussing the first commitment, but I mean, you know, when we get to the main thing is in the first commitment, we're really talking about how we are working on ourselves, we're working on just reining in ourselves and taking responsibility through commitment to harmlessness and a commitment to just fundamentally acknowledging that we are basically responsible for our own experience, so we can actually look at that and change it and not simply become automatons or continue thinking that way. Has anybody had any problem with that so far?
phrase it in another way. Well, what have you learned so far?
Yeah, I mean, in other words, has that brought up challenges that you would like to share? Or
there you go.
Do we have a chance to discuss that previously?
Sure, sure. Oh,
I mean, just briefly.
I think it's good to talk about what people are working with.
Have you felt, I mean, some of us here have taken refuge, so some of us haven't, but it's okay either way. Just looking at the material and thinking about that, how does that seem?
Go ahead. I recently took both vows because I was at the workshop with Anam Tubton, and he didn't do just the refuge. He had to do both, and I went, oh my God. So I just really struggled with it. It has, I think, changed the way I look at things a little bit. And I'm trying not to get on the bus so often. You know, it says I'm no good. but it's still hard. It's a struggle to see things differently and to not get into unproductive mind sets that I might have been prone to for a long time.
That's big, actually, what you just said. That's huge.
It's worth saying loudly.
Oh, well, anyway. That's a better thing.
Because other people may want to hear it, too.
Michael couldn't hear me.
Oh, just that. I mean, I've struggled to get into other mindsets. You heard it.
Oh, you heard it. Okay. Well, that's fine.
Sorry, Michael. Please.
Yeah, but we're also recording it.
To me, my name has changed. You know, the more I, you know, meditate, the name I received then at Refuge has taken on a lot more meaning. So even though it's secret to me, you know, it's very private to me, every single meditation involves my name. So I think it's had an impact in that it implies the vows are taking more meaning.
Mm-hmm. That's remarkable.
Are you talking about, so anything that we've talked about from now through this last chapter? Oh, okay. So I really like the, it was late in the chapter, the part about looking, sort of waking up every day and saying, I wonder what's going to happen today. Living one's life, they said, as an experiment. Mm-hmm. So I was just thinking about that. We so often, like, you know, we have our calendars. She taught me to use it. Anyway, and you know, you plan everything. And then you get really so aggravated or upset or disappointed when things don't go exactly the way you planned it. And when you think about it, it's so ridiculous to think that everything would go that way. So I'm thinking it'd be better. You have to know where you're going, or they have some plan, like what lunch you're taking to work or what. But to marvel at the end of the day and how many things actually went a way that you wanted them to go. Because rather than the assumption being that you have control and you know what you can, what's going to happen, and get upset or sad or angry that it doesn't, to be aware of how there are just all these unknown possibilities every single minute. So I like thinking about that.
Yeah, well, that's a shift certainly in terms of this one. Mm-hmm. Because I think when we're really trying to get more in control of our experience in the first commitment stage, where at least, you know, we're not going to just function automatically and let things happen because we can't even understand why we're doing anything, but just going through a series of reactions. Yeah, that's good. Interestingly, you know, even though, and it's true that we get into this issue of struggle with practice, but, you know, the way they talk about it is you stop struggling. I mean, that's actually the twist to this whole thing. Is every Dharma teaching I've studied talks about getting out of the way as a state of relaxation, of not just going off and, you know, being somehow driven to do this or that or the other thing, but actually more deeply relaxing into being present. Now, of course, at this point, if we've read this chapter, it introduces the notion of basically going outside of ourselves. because, you know, we have been dealing with the way Pema brought this up in the first chapter is about the notion of dealing with groundlessness and the anxiety that we experience when we actually pull away all our little props. You know, we see those, they're no longer so fascinating or absolute. And then, you know, sometimes they just sort of melt away and we're sitting here going, well, you know, what is this? I mean, you know, I don't feel like I'm standing on anything. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where I'm come from or where I'm going. You know, I had all these big ideas about what it was like and who this I was going to be and or supposed to be and this and that. And then groundlessness is actually just sort of we begin to realize how we really underneath all of those little things that we had is just kind of like open space and empty. And we experience that often as a source of anxiety. Right?
That's very well said. And that's what happened to me yesterday out of the blue. I mean, it's awful. It really feels terrible, I have to say. You know, it's really, you know, groundlessness. That sense of groundlessness. And you know, yeah, like, what have I been doing all this meditation for all these years? What has it gotten me? And, you know, I'm always telling people, you're not going to get anything out of it. And I'm, like, telling myself,
yeah, what?
What is this all about? Maybe, you know, do I really, what am I doing? And everything seemed really shaky. And it was sort of, it is a loss of ego. I mean, that's the way I experience it. Because all the props, you know, like the phone and the schedule and what you're going to do and what you're going to cook and all these things come together to, it's almost like a web we create. Mm-hmm. It's full of holes, but we're standing on it. And it's what's reliable. I know I was going to go to this meeting that night and I had to prepare or do something, you know, whatever. And then, but underneath the whole thing, there was just anxiety. So it's very interesting. Like, these things seem to not come very often for me, but when it comes, it's just like, and
so it suggests that even when you've been practicing for a long time, it's like supposedly the three people in front of you here, you still are subject to the attack of believing someone's there, you know, that something is actually real here, you know, this thing is somehow solid. And, you know, what we discover way back when, in the first commitment, is nobody's there when we actually look. You know, that's the first thing. Identitylessness, it means, yeah, I have a name, and we all have names. It's just like, and we put names. So this is the first thing. I have this name that somehow I carry around with me and this idea of who I am. So we begin to sort of let that go because we discover there's nothing to hold on to. And that's actually really freeing up, you know. I mean, from the other side of that,
yeah,
wow,
yeah.
I don't have to be anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't have to be, I don't have to do anything because there's not all this kind of situation of all these pressures coming at me other than the ones I create myself.
I actually went back to bed.
What time was it?
8 o'clock, I already had my breakfast. I just went back to bed. I said, I'm just going to lie here.
It's interesting because then you say,
I had this too.
I'll get cranked up into the day and I'm sitting here and I'm starting to do my stuff and suddenly I went,
I know, exhausted.
All I want to do is lie down.
I just need a nap.
I lie down for 10 minutes or 20 minutes and then it's okay because I opened up and stopped believing that what I'm doing is solid. You know, it's like suddenly, yeah, okay. So what we're opening up to is basically what emptiness, as we talk about, is really just a state of openness. You know, it's not some kind of a big vacuum where you walked into a house that somebody thought they lived in and nobody's there anymore and you're sitting there lonely and feeling sorry for yourself because, like, it's in everything. It's not just only when you're alone by yourself. It's in everything. But, I mean, the point is that it's also spontaneous. And spontaneous meaning there is nothing that has to shut you down or, you know, basically put you in a lock of any kind. So that's why when we talk about Dharma, we're really talking about some kind of freedom, real freedom. And it's interesting because the freedom actually comes through some kind of discipline. So they have an interesting connection, freedom and discipline. The discipline we have from that first one is being gentle. First of all, harmless means starting with being gentle to ourselves, right? We have a saying in the Shambhala teaching, a warrior of meek is merciful, gentle to himself and merciful to others. And so that translates in terms of what this is about. I mean, in a very interesting way of putting it, is because we're doing the notion of warriorship in this chapter. And warriorship is traditionally associated with being a bodhisattva. So a warrior, in this case, starts with just basically having to be open and vulnerable and at the same time realizing that vulnerability is a source of strength. That's what we discover. It's not like we're just walking around and shaking with, you know, anxiety and fear about something's going to happen. It's more like, openness and vulnerability allows you to discover some sense of open. It's open inside and it's open outside. So there's a sense of just naturally being there. You know, which could almost in more traditional societies be defined as being stupid. Because you don't have any pretensions at that point. You know, you're just there.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words...
You're connected because you're open.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, you don't have this agenda going on all the time about being somebody who has to do something and prove yourself to somebody, yourself, and basically yourself, but, you know, you're using other people as a prop for that. So, okay.
One of the interesting examples that she gave about how the sort of concept of self is so, she came to this realization how it's so, I don't know, like not really there. How she was seen one way as the student and one way as the teacher. I have that. I work at a couple different nature centers. And I'm just, it's like I'm perceived different. I do exactly this, well, it's probably not exactly, but more or less the same work, have the same level of skill, et cetera. And just because of the structure of one place and the way I'm looked at, it's like I'm perceived differently in one place than another.
Right.
And, I mean, it gets to me. I mean, one place is like, oh, she's so smart, she's so competent. The other place, the more disrespectful place, is kind of like, it kind of put everyone down. So, but, it, you know, it's, but which is real? Mm-hmm. None of them.
Exactly.
Perfect.
You begin to realize how all this is like shape-shifting, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, and so, well then, why do I have to take any of those seriously?
It's really the projection of the particular other person or people there.
It's everybody. We're all co-participating in a projection.
Yeah. But you don't have to buy into it. Yeah. No. That's what you're saying,
you
right?
Play with
right
that.
If I meditate before I go there, I have the gap. And sometimes I look at them cross-eyed and they realize what they're doing. And it's kind of like, oh yeah, sorry, or oh, I didn't mean to, whatever.
Wow.
It helps. Not necessarily meditating right before. Sometimes it has a 24-hour, it seems to have a 24-hour half-life for me.
Meditate while you're standing.
That would be
really
good.
So yeah. I think that you're just on the spot. You know, you're not trying to like get into an account posture or anything. But this is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So the kind of like the again, we have another twist here, or just a way of saying, okay, it's all this kind of continuous projection. But you know, and I'm not going to stop other people projecting.
You can't.
But you know, I can play with this situation. And this situation affords this kind of possibility, so I'll just go do that. And then I can completely go somewhere else. And part of the meditation training helps us become much more flexible so that we can just go with it.
Yeah,
we're not trying to say, well, wait a minute, I was just back there for 2 hours, and now I can't deal with this because I got to debrief and completely dismantle.
Somehow... I don't know if it's related at all, but I think one of the most out-of-control things I have is when I'm at the community day center with the homeless people who are, you know, high and addicted and drunk and telling me they want this or that or swearing at me. I mean, it's you certainly feel like you're in sort of the middle of the river, although I've got a couple pals. Because I can go say, Nina, you know, this guy gave a urine test and I think he used tap water. or I can talk to Carolyn, or, you know, I've got a couple of pals to check with that are swimming over there. But it just, I don't know if it's related at all, but it just feels very out of control. You know, there's a sort of a something I'm supposed to do, but it usually doesn't get very much done. What I'm supposed to do is...
You have an agenda, but you don't meet it or something,
oh,
right?
it's not going to happen. Yeah. I've got people angry at me for not doing something that's not doable.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing we can do about that. That's their story that they're working on. And if you're dismantling your stories, then, you know, it leaves them more room to ventilate and discover there's not much that they have to worry about because you're not resisting and pushing back.
No, it doesn't do help to push back. I mean, I've done it, but I'm, you know.
Well, that's a change.
Tried that.
That's a change.
Oh, no, I've tried
you
that.
You used to, you talked about.
I still try. Somebody really gets out of hand, though.
Wow.
Well, that's different.
Well, that's different.
You know, then
you have to have boundaries.
You're thinking about everybody in the room. We got boundaries to mind.
Yeah.
And if we, you know, you can't be in this room if you're not going to acknowledge some sense of boundary. I mean, that's just part of what needs to be here. Let's go on then. We have been discovering or exploring, and of course, this is not going to end here, but the issues of self. But now, we're moving into this thing called other, and it's not just other people, but other. This is why it's such a big project, you know. It's like it's not like everybody who takes a bodhisattva vow is supposed to become a doctor or a therapist or something, you know. It's like that's not what it relates to. It isn't. We were suddenly supposed to be nurses or handmaids for everybody. But when you actually look at what other means, it means pretty much everything. It means appearance. I mean, and so. that means how things appear and, you know, how the world fills up with not only people but beings of all sorts and trees and objects and colors and dynamics that we work with in this situation. So what we're learning about, really importantly, is as we open up to this, is discover how, you know, we can be here for that. That we actually are here, ultimately, for each other and for everybody. As bodhisattva precept, the precept of just being available and being open to everybody. So that has a lot to do, and of course, so there's a couple of things. She describes here. This can be a source of inspiration, this quality of going towards or opening up to fearlessness. And in the case of fearlessness, we only know fearlessness because we discover fear, right? Fearless is not coming from some other place that doesn't know fear. Fearlessness can only come when we know fear. Does that make sense? So, that's one of the things we're learning about is discovering how our fears, they start with me, and then we begin to see how my fear is shared by or partaken of and expressed or experienced differently by other people and situations. But, I mean, basically, it's all a big story, right? And it's not here. I mean, or it is. There are difficulties, and you know, when we're open to those difficulties, they make it a lot more navigable.
What makes it what?
Navigable.
Oh, navigable.
Yeah, that we're actually, like, if we're not used to the term of being in a river, well, okay, if I'm in a river and I'm going with that river, instead of trying to fight against being washed downstream, you know, rather I turn it into going with what's happening right now and just relating to it just as it is, not where I think it's going, but where I am.
But I think this, I don't know, I get caught here because between fear and fearlessness and Pollyanna or trying to like rise above it all. But when I really look at the situation we're in, it's dire. If we just talk about climate change itself and you know, all these hurricanes, and it is actually happening. And I turn the tap water on and I go, it's not always going to be here. This water is not going to come out of this tap like this that you can drink. I mean, you realize that these problems are gigantic. So that's where the fear comes in for me, because it feels hopeless and it seems so huge. And people have been trying to make some changes, and then you have this government that's just It just seems crazy. So that's where I feel like, you know, are we being idealistic and Pollyanna that we're talking about being fearless, or just, you know, are we unrealistic? Or what does this really mean in terms of a Buddhist view?
Well, doesn't it mean you really see what's there, you really acknowledge it, being realistic about it? You're not talking yourself into saying it's not there because I'm really supposed to only be seeing things.
But maybe you feel a lot of fear because you see what's there.
Well, you can...
Where does the fearless...
If you get overwhelmed, you can't do anything.
Well, so being overwhelmed then is completely allowing that fear to, because you are so willing to solidify your experience that you become completely helpless. And I give up, you know.
Right.
Forget it. Let it, the whole
That's
thing go to hell.
I'm just characterizing your mind.
You know what I'm thinking of, though, is Sandra, because she always used to say in these situations, okay, guys, we're being, you know, real upper class here, that we have the luxury to worry about climate change, because there's a lot of people who don't have the luxury of worrying about that. They're worried about where the next meal is coming, like the Rohingya.
Well, the people on Mexico Beach certainly.
Yeah, I know.
I can afford to worry about it.
Well, and the but the people,
their homes are gone.
But like the, you know, they're worried where the next mouthful is coming from more than.
That's right.
You know,
well, that, and that's one
more
of the problems.
Immediate need.
Well, one of the problems we have to understand, it's true. I think Sandra was correct. In order to practice Dharma, you've got to have three things. You have to have food, shelter, and clothing. I mean, these are completely essential. If you don't have those things, then you haven't got the time and energy to be looking at what is creating the world, how is my mind working.
I mean,
you're just dealing with such a fundamental level of survival.
And the people,
those questions can't possibly enter, and that certainly includes things like climate change or any of the other big questions that face us.
And the people like on Miami Beach, too, that true, they're dealing with both.
Mm-hmm.
And but like the Rohingya that are being marched out of Myanmar,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't even have the hope of the government bringing them food or anything. I know. Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean, the people in Miami Beach at least have a chance.
And,
you know, the Rohingya, there's so many people. Huh?
Today they have a chance.
Today they have a chance. Yeah, they might not before, but I don't know.
So the question that Emily's bringing up is, what can we do? I mean, is this something that we just have to sort of let be because it's beyond our control? And, you know, one of the things I think that we discover in this little project we have of working on ourselves and then opening ourselves to the world is that that the mind has powers that are not only simply attributable to single one person making an effect on the world and changing everything, as much as a coming together or a concerted joining with others of like mind. So one of the strengths of Dharma is having a community.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just a bunch of little isolated atoms floating out there that has no relationship to anything, but rather there's a possibility of some energy. That's what actually we call a mandala further on down the road here, which actually is a source of strength and power that can actually have effect, but the effect can often be subtle. It's not just something you're going to be able to read about in the newspaper tomorrow and go, you know, 15 people got together and meditated for 15 years and suddenly the world changed. Don't you see it? You know, the fact is that it is changing, and it's very important not to be overwhelmed by also the way you're being presented with news that makes it potentially so hopeless.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I sit around watching, personally, I spend hours a day looking at news. I mean, listening to news and exploring and what's going on. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I just watch this and I realize part of what I'm watching, what other people are just telling me what they think or want me to believe. It doesn't matter which side of the spectrum, political spectrum they're on. And I mean, for me, I'm just kind of breathlessly experiencing or opening myself up to that, so I understand the dynamics.
That this mantra might include other people besides this group, In other words, anytime you're anywhere, you might find people who share your possibility of space.
That's right.
In the supermarket or on the street, and it could be the homeless.
That's nice, Michael.
So I just wanted to go into this statements that we encounter in the book here. How do we understand then how others are more important than we are? Because it's one of the key points of these teachings. Is we begin to see that other people are more important than we are.
I think it's incredibly freeing. I mean, it's incredibly freeing.
Yeah.
Well, because then, like anything you get, say you're worried about, you know, you want to get this book published, a story, another children's story. You're afraid you're going to send it to these different editors and someone's going to steal your idea after all that work that you did. Well, if you really think it's a great idea or a great story and someone else steals it, great, it's still out there. And then you have less work to do. And they don't pay much anyway. So it's that whole competitive thing. Suddenly, anything
you can always get a copyright. You do have certain legal protection.
Right, I know that.
You know, you don't have to wait for somebody else to do it for you.
Technically. No, well, that's a whole other story. We can talk about that later. But, ideas are not copyright. So,
no,
you can just have a story and it can be basically exactly the same. But the point is, if it really isn't just about you, and suddenly it really doesn't matter, you have all that anxiety and defensiveness that you don't have to worry about.
Mm-hmm. You're so creative and you can come up with another idea.
One of the best things. It's more freeing. I think it would lead to that feeling that you could just come up with something else. But I wanted to bring the fearlessness thing. So the way I understood it was, I think you said this already, Michael, but you're not like pretending, oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. It's like you just really see it. Mm-hmm. You're like fearless about seeing how horrible things are, and then you know what to do, or you have some possibilities of what to do. That's my understanding of it.
Well, and so that's why we have this word samsara. And, you know, samsara really is about the state of confusion and horrific quality. And then we look at nature. You know, which if we're divorced from it, we're just sitting here like taking a little field trip into the woods and, you know, having a nice day in the pines and all that. Great. But, you know, actually, it's a pretty tough place.
Oh, yeah.
It's just kill and be killed. It's like survival of the fittest.
We love when the kids are on a walk and the hawk comes down and eats a rabbit, and they love it. I mean, it's real.
And you know, there's some beauty in that because we love the hawks. They're beautiful creatures. And they're just doing, like lions kill because that's what they do. That's how they live. It's not like a lion can go and get a little boiled water in the stove and put something in there and go vegetarian, you know. It's like they can do what they have to do. So everybody's doing what they have to do. And so what Emily's concern is, and I know Michael's and many of ours, is everybody in this room probably, is just a question of the condition of where this planet's going. And I think we have to have faith in the whole process. We have to have faith in ourselves to start with, faith in the power of our own minds. If we don't have that, then we can't ever trust other people's capacity to also be concerned and be able to work together. Well, we have to start with that sense of faith. You know, that's really an important one. If we just give up and say, well, it's just too much. I end up on the wrong planet. You know, I just have to figure out how to live this thing out and get out of here. It isn't working like that, you know. I mean, we really...
Or you could see it from a bigger picture, too, because it's karma. I mean, it's how we abuse the planet and dump stuff in the ocean. And the
planet has been this hot before, and... It will go through a cycle.
Well, but there is something else, and this is connected with the text, which she talks about stages. And one of the stages of this bodhisattva path is discovering this interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's happening as a result of all this information getting is actually realizing there's much a greater chance of understanding the interconnectedness of everything together rather than simply being able to fragment off and just be so involved or absorbed in your own little world of relationships and people you engage with and your thoughts and ideas that, you know, nothing else ever goes beyond that. I mean, in fact, we are more deeply interconnected and we're beginning to understand what this means more than ever before. That's why there's so much concern.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
It isn't like everybody had evil intentions who were creating this mess in the first place. They were just doing what they thought they had to do. They didn't think about the fact that they were destroying the planet, and they certainly didn't necessarily do it intentionally.
I'm not sure that's totally true. Well, there is some evidence that the oil companies have known what's going on for a lot longer than they're saying.
That's true. But it isn't like every single person who participates in that.
Yes, not everybody turns their car on and drives around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're doing it all the time. We turn the car on, we drive, you know, we get gassed up, we drive, we let go on trips, travel, you know, drive forever and all this kind of stuff. And we're partaking of it no matter what, right? But, I mean, I think the important thing is seeing. This is actually seeing and sensing and being sensitive to the amount of pain, but not turning it into a source of my own suffering. Then I can't do anything about it. You know, all I want to do is crawl in bed and get under the covers and go off. So, and on the other hand, you know, on the other hand, the other extreme, you could say, is your... You know, when you feel like, I got to get involved in every single activist project going on right now. I got to give $10 here every day. I got 15 or different requests. I got to do them all. I can't.
No.
You know, so there's got to be some kind of a balance of just being present, first of all, and trusting ourselves that if we are truly present and really relating to the situation as it is, where we are, in the moment that we are, it's actually enough. But we're talking about something here. Bodhicitta. What does bodhicitta mean? Does anybody have any ideas about that?
Awakened heart, mind.
Bodhicitta is mind, kind of mind thinking or the mind, the way the mind is. So awakened mind, awakened heart, mind heart, yeah. And so that's really important, because you know that's where being authentic is, and I think that's the most important thing we can do: is be authentic. We can be true. This is how we're going to actually experience reality, and we're going to discover that it doesn't necessarily make us feel better. You know, one of the things we always want is rewards for, you know, trying very hard to get real or getting work done. So I'm going to feel a lot better. I'm going to feel great. You know, I'm going to be happy. And, you know, a lot of people who say they're happy are people who you don't want to get near for the most part because they're happy creating a mess, you know. I don't know if happiness is really the answer, except, of course, you know, we would like other people to be happy because we want them to do well. From that point of view.
I feel like one of the best feelings in my life has been when I'm part of a group of physical therapists who really work together to make something happen, and I'm not alone with it, and it's like a community. It's just... I don't know if that's connected at all, but it's...
Well, you're talking about working for someone's benefit.
Right.
Making something happen is actually, in that particular case, trying to bring benefit.
Well, it's to do it with other people has been
in a group.
Like really just a joy at times, you know, to have the support of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you're quoting exactly and putting the words you're taking out will take out of what I was going to say, which is basically that sense of greater benefit involves being involved in a larger space.
So you steal the wheelchair and you send it to Peru. Just what we did.
Oh, cool. Steal another one and send it to Peru. It was old or somewhere else.
It was old. Oh, it was the only thing that fit.
So yeah, here's this. There's a discussion about vow and affirmation of the vow on pages 70 and 71. So we'd like to read that bottom paragraph starting on page 70.
Page 70.
Yeah.
Bottom paragraph. We don't graduate from one commitment to the next. The commitment to not cause harm stays in place as the foundation for the commitment to take care of one another. The training in not acting or speaking in a way that escalates suffering, the training in acknowledging our triggers and staying present with discomfort, is essential if we wish to go further. The commitment to not cause harm helps us cut through self-deception and develops a friendship with ourselves. Okay, this goes... I'll finish this.
Yeah.
With ourselves, a friendship that deepens as we begin to look closely at ourselves and lay aside the habits that cause us continued suffering. The warrior commitment rests on that basis of self-honesty. When we meet our edge, when life triggers our habitual responses, we train in catching them, knowing that if we speak or act out of shenpa, we won't be able to respond appropriately and support others.
Okay, so does anybody have any thoughts about that or how we can relate to that? Shenpa is basically just is confused mind.
So it's giving some meaning to the commitment, but, you know, saying what does this mean? What are we going to do with this? What do we do after we make a commitment?
Well, what are we making a commitment to?
To help others, to be there for other people.
Yeah.
And she's saying what you have to do first. First, you have to do the.
You're resting
don't
call, on.
Don't cause harm.
That first foundation is giving you support for recognizing how to be gentle.
And then you're committing to sort of taking it into your meditation and working on it.
Right. And then post meditation, what about?
Being there for others, supporting people.
Well, it's not like one size fits all and we're going to just have some simple nostrum.
Well,
she
talks about meeting your edge when you recognize what bothers you and what makes you unable to.
Yeah, and that can happen right in the middle of a conversation with somebody else. You know, what really, you're engaged with some situation and suddenly it emerges. So that's the exact moment when, you know, you can actually relate to just seeing it. The understanding is seeing it is enough. I'm not trying to change anything. I just needed to see it. When I see it, it begins to change itself. It starts to release. This is a very important teaching. It's going to go way beyond this level of commitment, because this is where the power of our experience, our meditation, gives us an understanding that the Vipassana meditation of just seeing, basically seeing, is enough. You know, nobody's going to go out there and beat themselves up because, I just had a bad thought about you. You know, what can I do? You know, get down on my knees and beg for forgiveness. You know, it's just basically, you just drop it. You learn how to drop it. Yeah, you drop it. You see it and you drop it. And seeing it makes it easier to drop it because you're just seeing this as a thought. And, you know, after a while, as you begin to see more of the thought, I don't have to go along with these just because they're there. It's not like I have to, that's not a command because it's in my head. You know, it's more about just realizing that actually, first of all, I don't want to be part of what where that's going to take me if I follow it. I can see that. Then the next stage, which is more kind of advanced in the context of awakened mind, is that actually that's helping me wake up. So it isn't like, oh, that wasn't supposed to be there. It's actually, thank you, you're helping me wake up on the spot. I'm really much more here now than I would have been if I was just going along and I didn't have any thinking or thoughts that were unpleasant or difficult.
Or if you didn't notice them.
Yeah, or you just don't know. You're noticing, and then noticing is part of this kind of the scenery, but it's also a little bit of a fuel for awareness.
Right, it's kind of energetic in a way.
At that point, it becomes energetic, and actually, that then you actually become much more energized to work with the situation. That means being in a situation with people who you may or may not like, and even when you think you're around people you like, you're going to find something you don't like. You know, so it's like these things are these little quirks, these little pops, these little pop-ups are actual opportunities to actually just see, and then. There's some sense of, okay, you know, right?
This is, you know, to me, this book gives, there's something about the way this is presented that has actually penetrated to be able to make changes where before, you know, you'd sort of see it and then you'd still do the same old thing. But there's something about this book, and it's just what you just said, Michael, I don't even, couldn't really even repeat it, but how... You see, and then there's the next step after you see it, and instead of just doing the habitual thing, then there something happened to me that made me change my pattern, and it's very liberating. And I don't know if it's...
Was that when you went to bed?
No. Well, that was liberating too, because I never would do that. Uh-huh. So that was actually pretty good. That was a breakthrough for me, giving in to... collapse. But no, it's just there's something about being willing to see the pattern, and then there's something about some confidence maybe in you don't have to follow through with that same pattern and feel the same old thing. Mm-hmm. There's something going on here, and I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it. You're shaking like you know what I'm saying.
I think it's a brilliant book. I think it's excellent. I think it's basically that she's such a good teacher and so clear. And also, it's cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they got it from the Buddhists.
Uh-huh.
But that's basically what they say. You know, like you don't have to believe everything.
Yes, you don't have to believe
that, that thing. And then just watching your thoughts.
Something now.
To go there.
Page 72. There's a little section. A little suggestion to try flashing into the present. So this is what we introduced before, because everybody was here earlier when we introduced the notion of absolute bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Absolute bodhicitta.
We can all just do that for a minute.
Okay, we'll do that.
To remind ourselves how easy it is. Just take a good posture for a moment.
Are you going to do it?
He's leading.
You're reading it.
I'm not going to read it. I'm going to just walk us through, and then we can look at how this is slightly different. Because I just want to remind us what we discovered this before. We just sit up straight, look out. And just that. Just in that moment of just releasing into right now. So let's translate that in terms of what she's saying here by looking at that. And who'd like to read that one? That little section bound by the two bars.
Page 72.
Yeah.
Okay. Kathleen,
is that the first come into the present?
Mm-hmm.
First come into the present. Flash on what's happening with you right now. Be fully aware of your body. Its energetic quality. Be aware of your thoughts and emotions. Next, feel your heart, literally placing your hand on your chest if you find that helpful. This is a way of accepting yourself just as you are in that moment, a way of saying, this is my experience right now, and it's okay. Then go into the next moment without any agenda.
Emily, how do you see that applying to what you're telling me earlier about just how crazy and bad off the world is? Can you do that?
It brings it back home very immediately. First, there's a sense of opening into a more spacious quality, but then also being grounded in your own body, so that there's a sense of acceptance of what's happening right there. And then whatever comes from that, whether it's some action or non-action, it comes from a true place rather than from concept.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so what's happening there, what we just did when we do that flash, and this is why if you can try to do this a few times a day, it will not be bad at all, is actually you're joining your body and mind together in that moment. When you really do that, when you're really setting up straight and you're sensing yourself completely being present, you're joining your mind and body. And at that point, your thoughts just cut off, even if they are running lickety-split all on front and backwards and every other way, just right on the spot. So there's a form, it's kind of refreshing to have that kind of a synchronization of the mind and body. And it's internal, something we do ourselves. This is called inner alignment. Think about that as a keyword you can use for yourself. Mm-hmm. Inner alignment. So I'm aligning myself. Join body and mind together here and now on the spot. And it's really simple. So, we don't have to be carrying around big thoughts or fancy ideas. It's just really being here.
That's very physical, too. It feels very... Yeah, it's grounding, too, obviously, literally.
We're talking about grounding. Meanwhile, we know, all the shakiness we've been going through and the groundlessness because I can't really actually trust anything. It's all slippery, but I can really be here. In the midst of all that, I can really be here.
Right.
And that's something we have to really experience for ourselves to know that that's true.
Is it like trusting your body in the totally, chaotic, unpredictable environment, but still,
yes,
you trust your body, starting with your breath and your heartbeat.
And so, what happens?
Alive. So,
what actually happens? And you can see what's going to happen is that even if it only lasts for a couple of minutes, there's an evenness, an equilibrium that's simply really simple, and it's okay. It's in balance, and that's what we want. We want to have an evenness. We don't want to have to be worried about either being way up, exhilarated, or completely down in the dumps, in the bottom of the sewer, but actually just simply even. Wherever that takes us, wherever we find ourselves, be even in that second, in that moment. And that's where we actually can find some sense of alignment. So we become much more capable of dealing with the situation that's there, of responding to the situation. When we're in the room with other people, working with other people, we get much more sensitized to, or curious, and actually interested in, what are you doing? What's your concerns are? Rather than, how am I going to deal with all this, somehow, in the midst of all that alignment, we kind of get out of the way.
I think you're sort of using your body. Your body's like a tool.
That's right.
To keep you present.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just thought of something. From a psychological standpoint, I think it's that when everything is feeling, chaotic and unpredictable, and we have anxiety and all that stuff, at a basic level where it feels like we're going to die. It basically feels like we can't handle it. Physically we're going to die. And so that's the anxiety. And that But then when we, you know, focus on our breath and maybe put our hand on our heart, we say, oh, okay, I'm still alive. Like, I can live in this samsara, in this chaotic world, and so it's kind of like a reminder. Works for me, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, we pop out, what you know, as we go further along in the end of these studies, we're really interested in understanding what's causing samsara. And what is samsara? You know, I mean, it's like something that I am actually the basis of the source of samsara. You know, I'm not going to blame anybody else. I know if I experience samsara, it's because I am creating that myself.
It's him. He created samsara.
Well, okay, now we know.
No problem. Isn't that a relief?
Yeah. That's Michael Fagan all along.
All right.
Fagan all along.
Fagan in the library.
So that's where it begins and ends.
Yeah, right.
And so back to this notion of alignment, where we pop out of it. You know, it's like it's just an interpretation we're putting on something. Well, we actually get into this thing about what we call emptiness, which is completely open and fresh and completely without any kind of presupposition, you know, or thinking about what it is or judgment. We're just dealing with it, you know. So it doesn't matter whether conventionally it's great or lousy or beautiful day or terrible day. We're just there with it, you know, on the spot. And actually we discover wherever we are, that can be a source of that freshness and of that openness so that we can go right into it and work with it.
And that's what liberation is, because you're not trying to control the environment. Or you're just being with what is there, so you're not, you have freedom. I mean, that's the freedom we have, is not to solidify and,
that's right,
and make it something else.
And so this may be something that, you know, then we're moving into a slightly higher kind of another, raising the bar a little bit when we get on page 74, because actually what we're learning about is, and Pema is very good at talking like this, you know, we're talking about constantly making commitment to be of service and being of help. Oftentimes we only do that by learning how not to do it. And she says, the warrior learns a lot by failing. We probably learn more from our mistakes than from our successes. And so we have to recognize when something doesn't work, and this is important, not to take it personally. Instead, we can follow Trungpa Rinpoche's suggestion, live your life as an experiment. Adopt an attitude of, I'm not sure what this will help, what will help in this situation, but I'm going to experiment and try this. So if it doesn't work, we try something else. But I mean, there's a lot more sense of adventure in this kind of notion. Mm-hmm. And when there's adventure, there's much more potential joy and energy available, rather than, oh my God, I got to deal with this, you know. You know.
So much lighter.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Yeah.
Well, you're both. It's 9 o'clock already.
Okay, well, it sounds like our adventure, at least in this department, is going to take a one-week hiatus. But I'm hoping that at least what I've been able to at least bring up is helpful tonight. And so one last thing, which is one note that I really wanted to share with you about this, is that warriorship is beyond labeling. So it starts with the labels we have in ourselves and everything we plaster on. And then the next step, which is a bigger one, is dismantling the labels of what we call consensus reality. That's the big job. Consensus reality is what everybody else thinks and what makes us think we're supposed to be this or that, or are this or that, because everybody else says so, because everybody else has been doing this forever, and you better get it with the program. You know, I mean, we're like taking apart the program and realizing, wait a minute, maybe there's something more to life than just these programs that are being imposed on us. And these things are things that everyone takes for granted. So it's part of this adventure. It's part of this sense of experimentation. And we're experimenting because it's completely pioneering from that point of view. So, you know, in that sense, unless you don't want to be a pioneer, But if you do, then it can be a great source of discovery. So it's not just like, I have this big job of saving the world, you know, my God, oh, poor me. You know, it's more about actually being in a really high adventure. Mm. Okay?
Yeah, that's